until the tabling in the House is done. But in this case, we are pressed for time. Also because of the 9 weeks we missed during the election. So next year we will have, I hope, a normal year. For the next 4 years we are here. That we can do it in an orderly fashion. But thank you for your attendance. Before the Treasury starts, I received a letter from Honorable Harris regarding a conference that was held in Cape Town, organized by the Department of Economic Affairs and the Department of Treasury, and the report appeared in the press on Business Day regarding this. And the friendly request that in future, if Treasury organizes conferences or discussions like this, that they also inform us in due course before the conference takes place. The Honorable Minister attended, and there were international academics also addressing this about the economic situation, the global crisis, and the answers to it. So I dealt with Treasury, I mentioned it to them, that they take note of it. Welcome again, and you must please introduce yourselves and then indicate who will be leading the presentation. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Keith Engel. I'm from the National Treasury. From the Legal Tax Design Team. And the chief director. And so we drive a lot of the tax policy proposals on our side. We're missing one person here, my colleague, Cecil Morton, who is the leading tax economist. Franz, you want to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Chair. Franz Tomasek from the South African Revenue Service. I do similar work on that side of the fence.
Cindy August, South Parliamentary Liaison Officer.
Nico Mare, Parliamentary Office of National Treasury.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. All right, I'll try to move this along here a little bit. Let me just give you the highlights and just a little bit about process first. If we go to the first slide, because a lot of you are new to the process. Nguni knows this process quite well, so you can go to sleep in this slide. We can move to the next. The slide, the giving effect to 2009 budget proposal. So just quickly to the next one.
Yep.
There you go. Just so you know the way the process works, every February our minister gets up and he announces the budget proposals, and in those budget proposals are tax proposals. And he also tables the budget review at that time. And in that budget review is the tax proposal spelled out in some detail. There you'll have a Chapter 4, and you'll have an Annexure C. The Chapter 4 are the main proposals, Annexure C are the more technical proposals. And that sets the outline for the year. So whatever you see that's in this legislation has come out from that period, has come out from that statement. So we try to act within those confines. That sort of sets the outliers. Once you're done with that, the way the process works in the National Assembly and the Standing Committee on Finance is we have a series of informal hearings. And during those informal hearings, we change the bill substantially. And then, because it is a money bill, you're not allowed to amend a money bill, except that new procedure is about to come in. But at this present time, you cannot amend the money bill. So all the amending is done at the informal level, and then we do a formal introduction where the bill is then tabled. And so I don't know how that's going to affect your processes. But needless to say, that's the basic way it goes. Then it goes to the committee, they process it, and there's actually a lot of engagement back and forth and a fair amount of debate, and the private sector community is usually heavily involved in those hearings. I raise that because I don't know, sometimes the select committee wants to attend those hearings and be involved in that, and one of the questions that we have to ask you as you go forward is how do you want to be involved in this process? Satisfactory for you, or would you like something else? And I think that's an engagement that we need to have. So I leave it at that, and I leave that for your consideration, Chair. Okay, moving on to the next slide. I just just basically what we were trying to achieve. And I think when we set the budget back in February, we were aware that the economy was on a slide downward. We felt it was going to be a slight slide. It turned out it was a little more dramatic than we had hoped. But at the time when we set the budget, we did a fair amount of stimulus. Now, one of the things that we did, the most of the stimulus, if you remember the Minister Emanuel's speech, was about being shovel-ready projects. So the stimulus was coming through government spending. On the tax side, we didn't have as much of a stimulus. It was mostly a little bit of tax cuts, mostly to keep make sure people didn't get punished by inflation, plus a little bit extra in order to stimulate consumption. So that was one of the big ones that was there. The other one to note was that the mining sector was getting hit very heavily. So the royalty bill, even though the royalty bill was set to take effect and raise additional revenue from the mining sector as of 1 March 2009, that was delayed for another year. It was actually 1 May 2009, so it was delayed till 1 March in order to make sure that our exports weren't affected. And just another theme that's been coming through, and you'll see this theme throughout, is environment. There are additional issues and concerns about the environment. One, well, I think everybody's seen a number of specials on TV now, but I think South Africa is unfortunately a fairly large polluter for being such a small country. And so there's a number of initiatives, and on the tax side, you've seen this as well, in order to encourage more environmentally friendly practices. Then just to talk about revenue trends, we estimated that we were going to lose about $13.5 billion because of inflation in order for the PIT relief, and there was some other additional $4.6 billion there on net revenue for GON. But I think the key point is the second bullet here, and that is that our revenues now are short, if you've heard the papers, by about $60 billion. Now, to some extent, look, the income tax, which is one of our biggest revenue raisers, but also the VAT, is based on economic activity. So as that economic activity slows down, your tax revenue goes down. Now, you can try to jack up that revenue more, but then what you're doing is you're putting a double burden on an economy. So as the rest money comes around and is circulated, you're going to collect tax less tax receipts. The question is how much borrowing you're going to have to do to make up for it. And so the issues that we will face in the next year or two ahead is how do we make up for these revenue shortfalls. So I don't think we're in a land of plenty right now. But that is an issue for later on, an issue for your consideration. Moving on to the slides, the summary of the main tax proposals, and they're keeping me moving, is the most biggest thing that you're seeing there is the PIT relief, personal income tax relief. Every year we adjust the brackets so that we try to reduce the tax on the salaried individual. That has been the main thing. You'll see that there's also quite a bit of assistance. I think it's on the next slide. Here, let's just jump over to slide 8 just to see the main issue. Go back one. The key here is the bracket adjustment. And it's very important here to note this because if we're doing our job right, we will be adjusting these tables. This is very important. This is your salary. So if we don't adjust these tables, you're going to get taxed more and more like every other salaried person. When we start not doing our job right, what will happen is you will find these tables are not adjusted properly, and you will find there will be a quiet creep in taxes accordingly upon the middle class. You want to hear more of a South African? I don't know if I can imitate that. I'm trying to get the New York at as best I can. Okay, fair enough. So, now one of the things that we've done, and I think Minister Emanuel was very successful on, is getting these rates adjusted to reduce the charges on the salaried individual. One of the things you'll see here on the lower end is the rebates, what you would see as thresholds. So in the prior year, if you were below 65, your first 46,000 salary would be exempt. Now it's 54. So what you're trying to do is help the lower and middle income classes. And this is a very important table to keep an eye on, because this is your main constituency. What you will hear in lobbying is there'll be another constituency looking for relief elsewhere. And if you give money away elsewhere, you won't be doing the relief here. But this group, the biggest group, they don't usually get representation in Parliament, because the big firms, the big law firms and so forth, they don't make money on this table. They make money elsewhere. So the key is to keep this table in mind. This is a very important table for your constituency. Anyway, you want to, let's see here, hit a few on interest-free thresholds? Okay, let me carry on. Then there are some things that we've done. These should be fairly quick. But before you go back one, there. Okay, one is the salary. The other is savings. We have a number of exempt savings things. What we're trying to do is exempt savings in order to encourage savings for lower and middle income people. So now you'll see that you can earn up to $21,000 interest tax free. So if you put it in the bank, that helps you. Foreign interest, foreign dividends is a much smaller one because we want to encourage you to have domestic investment. And then you also have capital gains. So if you sell shares and small holdings, you'll also have exempt gains there as well. So you'll see that there's a number of themes to try to get the lower and middle income to pay a little less tax so the burden doesn't fall on them. And then we're on the provisional tax issue.
I'll take this one because this is an administrative issue. Essentially what we do is just people have to pay provisional tax if they are not subject to pay as you earn. You know, you and I get an amount deducted every month as we earn our salary. People who earn other kinds of income, let's say interest, they don't have that kind of monthly deduction, so they have what's known as a provisional tax system, which is every 6 months they get to pay in. In order to assist taxpayers who are older than 65, we say they don't need to be in the provisional tax system if they fall below a certain threshold. And all we're doing here is we're saying, let's increase the threshold. Why don't we keep on increasing it to even higher levels? The problem is, if the threshold is too high, then when your assessment arrives in the post one day, you have a very big liability, as opposed to paying it off in installments. So that's the balance that's being struck, and so we've increased it to $120,000 this year.
The medical one, I think, is just an app. You'll see one thing just to note, that you contribute to your medical savings, you get a deduction for that.
Excuse me.
I didn't understand that.
Are we going through the presentation and then you have questions? Thank you.
The normal procedure, listen to the presentation, after that, take questions. Please, question.
Okay, fine. Sorry about that. When you make contributions to your medical scheme, you get a deduction for that. It's a small way of assisting you to have medical cover. And so you'll see every year those thresholds get adjusted as well. And I think the basic point here is every year you'll see adjustments to these thresholds in order to provide relief again to the middle and lower classes. So these are important. We'll move on to the next one. Now the big issue is on the next few slides here, the motor car allowance. Now, the motor car allowance, and you'll see it in the next few slides, I'm not sure I'll sort of discuss all few of them at once. The purpose of having an allowance for your car allowance is to assist you in your business travel. Now, what we mean by business travel is like when you have to fly, not fly to town, when you drive from business place to business place. Going to work and leaving work is not business travel. That is specifically not allowed. It's really pure business travel where you're going from Parliament to a government building. That's what you're supposed to be getting in the tax system. However, you have something called the deemed car allowance, the deemed kilometers. And the deemed kilometers was to just simplify things for everyone. But over time, people have used that to sort of falsify their claims that they're making business travel. Because if you drive 32,000, people say, well, I deem you to have business miles. Now, that 32,000 might be mostly, you know, let's say you want to just drive around on vacation. You can get the 32,000 racked up that way, and then you'll try to claim the business miles. That's not allowed, but people have done it anyway. And what has happened is with this deemed car allowance, effectively people are taking off commuting and basically personal travel. And over time, what we have done, if you go to slide 14, over time what we've done is we've been carving back, I think it's the next one, but we've been carving back this allowance, And so this is the final year of the allowance that we decided in order to eliminate it in this final year. And that was the point. I don't think we want to encourage people to do excessive travel. It's part of our environmentally friendly practice. You don't want people to encourage them to drive just for the sake of driving to get a tax deduction. And people can still claim their business travel, your actual business travel you should be getting a deduction for. But there you've got to record it on your logbook. But if you do it, the only thing to note is the logbook, it really will help you basically get a refund, I would assume, because it's not going to affect your paycheck annually, but it will affect you mostly at the end. And I think most people accepted that this was an unprincipled giveaway and that there was very little comment because I think most people realized this was wrong. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but that's there. Okay. The next issue is on pre-retirement and post-retirement lump sums. When you put money into your pension savings, that money builds up. You can have it in a provident fund or a pension fund or your retirement annuity, your RA. When you take the money out, you can take it out annually or you can take it out in a big lump sum. The tax system is trying to say that if you take it out in a big lump sum, we want a simplified averaging formula. The theory is that if you take it out a little bit over time, you'll be on lower brackets because you'll only be earning a little bit at a time, which helps you on that PIT table that I talked about earlier. So when you put the money in a big clump, if you don't have a special rule, you'll have a higher level of tax. So what we've created is sort of a simplified system of averaging where we're trying to approximate that averaging. And what we've done is if you take money out of a lump sum, you're on a special table. But the tables have two things. With the purpose of this table, you can go to the next one in slide 16. I'm going to go back and forth. We want to encourage you to retire. And hold your money till retirement. So when you retire, we try to give you a more generous table. So if you pull your money out of retirement, your first $300,000 is exempt. But if you go back to the other slide and you pull the money out before retirement, only $22,500 is exempt. So you'll see, if you look at those tables, it's always better to pull your money out on retirement, not before. And that's to encourage you to save, so that you're not a problem for the state. We want to make sure that you're not left destitute in your old age. We have a number of tax incentives around that. So those tables have been put in, and we try to make things simpler, so you can just see the tables. You didn't know what was there before. I think Ms. Nanguni remembers the formula B and the A minus C and the D. We got rid of all that. We wanted a simplified table so that you could understand what was going on with your retirement. So that's what we affected this year. The issue now at 17, to get to briefly, this back one, is that one of the issues says, well, if I pull the money out before retirement, you're basically penalizing me. What happens if I lose my job? I lose my job and the only thing I have is my pension fund. Now, I can't wait till 65 because I'm starving now. So I need the money now. So we put in a special rule that says if you lose your job due to retrenchment or you're fired, then if you need to take the money out, you'll get the benefit of the retirement tables at this time. But the way the tables work is they're cumulative. The more money you take out, the less benefit. So basically, you're accelerating your retirement benefits early, but overall, it'll even out over time. But again, this is a way of assisting retrenchment packages. Okay, moving on to slide 18. Learnerships. We have had, for a period of time, tax incentives for learnerships. And the purpose is to encourage the employer to train the employees. So if the employer trains the employees through a learnership program, they get effectively an additional deduction, or basically a double deduction for salary. It's almost, that's what's happening here. The thing is, this special incentive for learnerships we've had for a few years, but it became so complicated, nobody could even read the law anymore. It got so bad. So what we did is we went and we simplified the learnership thing to make it much cleaner and simpler in order to encourage learnership programs by employers. And basically what happens is if an employer sets up a learnership so that it's basically like an apprenticeship for the employees, that the employer will get a deduction, but they'll get this additional deduction for entering the program, this additional $30,000 for every year of the program. And at the very end, if the employer employee successfully completes it, they get an additional deduction based on the number of years. So if it was a three-year program, what would happen is you get a $30,000, the employer would get an additional $30,000 every year, and then at the end of the 3 years, it would be $90,000, three times 30 for the completion allowance. But basically, this was to make this thing more accessible, because if it was too complicated, smaller businesses couldn't use it. Now we're hoping that more people can participate because it's easier and cleaner. And that's always one of the trade-offs in tax. Fairness, complexity, trying to prevent avoidance, all of these things. And what we've done here is we've moved for simplicity, and we think this gets us there. That's slide 18. Portable spousal deduction. This is the estate duty. Now, when you pass away under current law, up to $3.5 million of your estate is effectively exempt. It's technically called a deduction. Now, the reason why we have this, again, is we basically, the estate duty is not designed to affect the middle and the lower income. What we're saying is you want to be able to pass things on to your children. However, once your estates become very, very large, then we start saying, well, you know, we don't want to encourage, you know, basically a permanent wealth class. And so therefore, you have an estate duty. Well, anyway, the way it works when you're married is that each member of the couple gets $3.5 million exemption slash deduction. Now, that effectively adds up to $7 million. The problem is, in order for both spouses to utilize it, they have to do a lot of tax planning. So, for example, if there's a husband-wife scenario and the husband dies, what the husband really wants to do is give most of his money to his wife. But if he doesn't give money to his children right away, he will not be able to use up his $3.5 million. So let's say he has a $5 million estate. If he just gives all of his money to his wife and then his wife dies, his wife will only be able to get the benefit of the $3.5 her estate. But if he gives away, say, $2.5 million, and she gives away $2.5 million, then none of the estate is taxed. So what you have to do is make sure you utilize both $3.5 million numbers. And there's a whole little cottage tax industry to help you do that. So, for example, if the husband dies, the wife gets the money, but it goes in a special trust, and it's a fairly complex procedure in order to make sure 3.5 is equal to 7, 3.5 times 2. So what we've done is we've had a proposal where we said, look, we want to get rid of all the tax advice and say, when you're married, effectively, you'll have the effective use of $7 million, both 3.5. If you can move the money around any way you want, and will effectively give it so that the full couple gets the double benefit. And this means basically that most people are not subject to the state duty except for they're very wealthy. So that was that proposal. Then we have some other proposals now on environment. If you move over. And CERs, they're called Certified Emission Reductions. What, I don't know if you've heard of these called carbon credits. You may or may not have heard of these. But basically what it's all about is this. The Kyoto Convention has tried to encourage two things. They're trying to reduce excess carbon, because all those carbons going off in the air heat up the world, and then the icebergs melt, and then you get, the worst thing is you get a two-hour video from President President Gore, and he tells you how horrible the world is going, because there's too many carbons and the world is heating up. So the Kyoto Convention is designed to get companies to reduce their carbon emissions. Now, the way they've done it is they've said that the wealthier countries of the world, Europe and Japan, will have to reduce their carbon emissions. And if they go beyond certain targets, they will face penalties. But then they've also tried to assist the developing world, because they feel that the developing world has actually suffered a disproportionate burden of the environment. And so the way these things work is that in developing countries such as South Africa, we get points for creating carbon credits. And you'll have a project like a landfill where you'll kill methane gases, which reduce carbon credits. And what happens is there's an effective subsidy going on. And if a company in South Africa eliminates carbon credits, they'll get these credits if they eliminate carbon. And when they sell these credits, however, they're going to be taxed. And what we've done is we've tried to encourage this by saying when you sell carbon credits, they'll be tax-free. And that's essentially what that proposal does. Then there's something else called energy efficiency. One way to reduce carbon credits and environmental damage is to be more efficient. It's not a matter of necessarily getting solar or wind, but just not wasting energy. So, for example, your solar heaters would help. Or even if you had a thermostat on your solar, you'll reduce energy without, you know, and that will be less wasteful. Well, businesses who are energy inefficient cost a lot to the environment. And so what we've done is what's happened is there's a number of departments who are involved in measuring energy efficiency. Because the goal is you want to keep production. You want to keep the factory working, but you want it to be energy efficient so it doesn't waste energy. And so you can measure energy savings from year to year. And what the tax system is doing is giving a special deduction when you have this form of energy savings. And that's what essentially we're trying to encourage. And that's what slide 21 and 22 is about. Then 23 is ad valorem emissions tax on motor vehicles. When you buy certain motor vehicles, they're luxury vehicles, or they have an ad valorem charge. And what we've done is on motor vehicles is we put an ad valorem emissions rate on that to the extent it's less environmentally friendly based on the amount of CO2's emission rate it is. So we're trying to discourage you from buying energy inefficient cars. Is that a fair way of putting it? Okay.
Could you clarify that one?
Okay.
Energy.
Yeah. Give a client communication on that, or okay, can you go for that?
Essentially, what we're saying here is that to the extent you have a car that generates lots and lots of exhaust emissions, so typically larger engines, so it will be more heavily taxed when you purchase it. Well,
although members, I was naughty to throw this in, but you can ask.
Right. Just to take two obvious examples. I mean, you could have a car with a 1,000cc engine, okay, which would then fall at the bottom of this table and have a zero tax applied to the ad valorem, okay? So carbon CO2 grams per kilometers, very low. On the other hand, you could have a 7-liter American V8, which would tend to fall very high on the scale and therefore pay more tax.
So we're encouraging you not to buy those energy efficient, inefficient cars, basically. Okay, then this one. There's something called a secondary tax on companies. When a company distributes a dividend, it's taxed on the dividend. Most of the world taxes the shareholder when a dividend is received from a company, not the company paying. And what we've done is last year we flipped the tax from the company to the shareholder. That's what the proposal is. And that will go into effect based on some treaties. What we've done this year is we basically refined that proposal. We cleaned it up so it was not energy efficient. It was paper efficient. It was lawyer efficient, so to speak. So anyway, that's what that basic proposal is about. I'm going to jump through past 25 and 26. Let me move on to slide 27. Telecommunications license conversions. Telecommunications industry is going through a lot of change, and one of the things they've been trying to do is promote more competition with telecommunications. And so everybody's operating on the same form of licenses. Now, the way the old license system worked is you got a license for the internet, you got a license for the phone, you got a license for this, and license for that. And what the ACOSTA did is they combined all the licenses and said, you get a telecommunication license at home. And what they did is they forced everybody to convert into a standardized general license. And that was all of the companies. And that was to make more competition and more fairness amongst the industry players. However, when they made that conversion, that would technically trigger a tax disposal, a capital gain event under the tax laws. And we didn't want to tax people for doing what the government wanted to do, was forcing a conversion of these rights into a simplified right. And so what we basically did is we said when this conversion happens, it will be a non-tax event. You're not going to get an exemption, you get a deferral. That basically will be treated as a non-event, and whatever value that's in those licenses, They will be taxed when the license is sold, but the mere conversion will be a non-event, and that should facilitate what ICASA was trying to do. Then there's something called international telecommunication, international submarine cables, so to speak. And what's happening is that our internet is not as fast as the European and U.S. internets. If you take a look at them, their internets are a little better because our internet cables are behind. And one of the things that is going on is off the east coast of Africa is a long submarine cable that is being installed in order to improve our internet communications. And what they wanted was the companies investing in these wanted to have a write-off for their investment in the cables. Now, under accounting practice, you get a 5% write-off. So from a tax point of view, you should match the accounting, and effectively that's what we've done here. It's not sort of just to treat them fairly, that's all. Okay? It's fine. Government improvements on leased government land. This is another one. We have a number of rules that if you make an improvement on government land, the improvement itself is really viewed as part of the land under Roman Dutch law. So if you lease somebody's land and you build a building on it, it's the person who owns the land owns the building, not the person who built the building. And there were some rules that said that if you built a building on somebody else's land, you couldn't get a write-off for the building if the landlord was an exempt entity. And there was some concerns, and the reason why we had that was in the 1980s there was a number of schemes where people were building on another person's property, and what they were trying to do was generate an artificial deduction. And they were involving with a number of, let me just leave them out. There were some serious problems there. What happened was we had an anti-avoidance rule, however, that started making it difficult for a tenant to build on government land. And that was a problem because oftentimes government enters into various forms of public-private partnerships where government offers the land and the private sector offers the building. And then the building couldn't be written off. Now, several years ago, we said, well, if you're involved in a formal public-private partnership, we'll allow you to get this write-off. But it turns out there are a lot of informal arrangements with government that are not a formal public-private partnership, and you should still get the write-off. So, again, what we're trying to do is encourage, especially municipalities offering government land in exchange for somebody building on it. And the write-off you're trying to get is to equal it as if you actually own the land, which would be a 5% write-off. So we're trying to put them in the place as if the owner in place, the builder in place, as if he owned the land that he was building on. That's all we were doing there on slide 29 to assist government. Liquidation of residence companies, you like that?
I'll give Keith the chance to rest his voice for a second and you can listen to a South African accent instead of an American one. Many years ago, there were some popular schemes running around where you could try and avoid your transfer duty when you buy a property by owning it through a company or a trust. Now, as far as the trusts were concerned, SARS never accepted that particular scheme, but it took a long time to get one of those into court. And as far as the company is concerned, we made some adjustments to the law in the early 2000s, 2003 if I remember correctly, to close down people trying to dodge transfer duty by using a company as the owner of the land and the house on it. What we also have is an exclusion for capital gains tax purposes that says that if you live in your own home, up to 1.5 million of the gain is exempt. Okay, it isn't taxed. Which takes most of our homes out of the capital gains tax system. Now, a lot of people who got into holding their residential properties, their own homes, in a company or a trust, because they were trying to get out of this transfer duty many years ago, now find themselves in a situation where they can't, in fact, access the capital gains tax exclusion for a residential property. Now, when we introduced capital gains tax, there was a two-year window where people could get the properties out tax-free. Unfortunately, a lot of people didn't take advantage of that, and they've been in the system ever since. What this proposal does is it reintroduces that window so that people can get the property out of the company back into their own hands. They can then qualify for the capital gains tax exclusion, and they can liquidate the company and get rid of it. That's great from SARS's perspective because that means there isn't a company cluttering up our register. It's great from the Cipro perspective because there's again another company that can go off their register. And it's great for the taxpayer because they now qualify for the capital gains tax exclusion. So this is a triple win situation. And hopefully anybody who's left with this residential property in a company or a trust and can take advantage of this will now do so.
Okay. Now, in the Tax Act, we have a number of incentives for small business because we recognize that small businesses have a more difficult time and the tax system is just trying to assist them in a certain way. Now, there are two major ones. One is if you're a small business company, you can get a 10% rate instead of the normal 28% rate. Another one is you might have an option to have this new presumptive tax. And the purpose of the presumptive tax is to simplify your affairs. And it's a presumptive turnover tax. So needless to say, small business has these two key incentives. But one thing is we have an anti-avoidance rule because what we don't want is we don't want a single large business to break up into a series of small businesses in order to get the relief. So, you know, you have a big business, your tax lawyer comes in and says, look, if you want small business relief, just say you've got 10 divisions, just form 10 different businesses, and then you'll get the relief. So we've had some anti-avoidance rules to make sure that a big business isn't pretending to be a series of small businesses. But in doing those rules, we ran into a technical problem, and that is that oftentimes you have things called shelf companies. And shelf companies are, instead of going to Cipro to register, you just buy these things off the shelf and you start up a company. And what happens is some of the technical anti-avoidance rules prevented you from getting small business relief when you bought these shelf companies from a shelf company provider. And what we've basically done here is we said in those circumstances, the anti-avoidance rules will be turned off, and we buy one of these shelf companies, it can get the same benefits as small business relief as anyone else. Then you've got some things here. This is very tax heavy. In the world of tax, a lot of time will be spent on cross-border issues because when you're dealing with offshore investments, there's a lot of money involved, and there's a lot of advisors involved. And one of the things is there's a series of rules to prevent you to make sure that when you go offshore that you really have a business there, that you're not doing it just to escape South African tax. And one of these rules come around foreign subsidiaries, that if a South African company sets up a foreign subsidiary, the foreign subsidiary income will be taxed unless you know it's doing a legitimate business. And one of the things that we've done this year is we refine the definition of what a legitimate business is, to tighten it up in some places, and in other places to make it more realistic commercially. So, for example, sometimes you'll have a company that will set up a series of companies offshore that are all working together. We just wanted to make sure those were treated as a single offshore enterprise. The other change was, what we're really concerned about offshore is you take the money and put it into tax haven. Because it doesn't help you to take money offshore to escape South African tax only to face UK tax. For example, in South Africa, our rate is 28%. Well, if you take your money offshore to the UK, you're faced with a 28% rate anyway. So you're not going to take the money offshore to avoid our tax just to pay UK tax. It just doesn't make sense. What we're worried about is you take the money offshore and put it in some little island, which is a tax haven, where there's basically no rate or a nominal rate of 3% or something like that. That's how people avoid taxes. So those are what the rules are about. Well, what we've done is we've said, if you move to a high-tax jurisdiction, we're not going to worry about it. And that's what the rules make very clear here. The anti-avoidance rules will only apply when you go to low-tax jurisdictions. And that means that SARS is not wasting time and they can focus on the areas of real concern. Then we have our favorite, the PBO activities. Now, the tax system contains some incentives for public benefit organizations. This was discussed back in 2000. Barbara Hogan was heavily involved in this. And many tax systems have that, and they have two sorts of incentives. One, you will often find a public benefit organization is tax exempt. That way it can build up its investment profits or whatever it's earned from its donations. And those things are exempt. The other thing is they give you a tax deduction for giving the money. So, for instance, if you want to give to humanitarian relief, you get a deduction when you give money. And that way we encourage you to help out public benefit organizations. Well, we have a list of eligible activities that is allowable and that falls within the list. Now, the agricultural trusts were exempt, but they were not, well, actually, no, they did not qualify. I think I got this one wrong. The agricultural trusts were not exempt, were partially exempt, basically. The agricultural trust did a lot of activities that were exempt, but there were certain activities that were falling outside the exemption. And one of those exempt those activities was helping out poor and emerging farmers. And that's a very important thing for the Agricultural Trust to do. And indeed, the Department of Agriculture wants those trusts doing that. So we wanted to make sure they fell within the PBO relief. The second area was the FSB Consumer Education Foundation. The FSB set up a special organization in order to encourage donations. And that money would then be used for financial literacy. And what we've done there is we've encouraged and said that to the extent you give to that organization, it's tax deductible. Those are the two that are there. And then the last of my voice is going to be on films. Now, this turned out to be a fairly controversial proposal. The first part of it was fairly straightforward, and that is, look, the film industry, the entertainment industry, by the way, breaks down into different parts. So you'll have the TV industry. That's up in Johannesburg. That is being mostly sponsored by SABC. And TV is not very expensive to get start up, but you know, we do have a fairly vibrant TV industry in the Johannesburg area. The other one is the film industry, which is in Cape Town. The film industry always raises major problems because you need large amounts of capital in order to get it going. And we do have a fairly large film industry here. But one of the difficulties that we have is that we find that films are always short about 20% of their funding. Now, what people try to do is they try to get money from their father, they try to get whatever way they can get the money. One thing that DTI set up was a film grant in order to encourage local film production. And what we said many years ago when they created these local film grants was that the tax system would exempt the grant. So DTI gave you money for your film, we would say it's tax-free. The difficulty was that DTI set up their funding structure with a special purpose vehicle. They required it to be done a certain way, and our tax exemption didn't envision what the DTI was going to do and how they were going to funnel the funds. And so what we've done is we revised our exemption to make sure it matches the DTI grant, and everybody was very happy with that proposal. But then there was a second issue around a film allowance deduction. And what happens is if you invest in the film, you get 100% immediate write-off. And that was designed to encourage high-net-worth individuals to invest in films. The problem over the last 30 years is we found that oftentimes people don't really invest the money in real films. They invest them in tax avoidance schemes, and the money never goes down to the actual film producers. It ends up going to the advisors and the banks and tax advisors. So over the years, we've been going back at this thing and cutting away the anti-avoidance. And this year, again, we started to suspect some avoidance, and so we were going to add additional things. We were going to exclude the banks and the insurers from being involved in the film incentive because banks, frankly, don't invest in risky ventures unless they take out the risk. And then usually the way you take out the risk in the film industry is you take out the film. So the money just goes back to the tax advisor. At the same time, there was some push to provide a little change in 24F to make it more attractive. And we put both issues in because we felt we were going to be trying to help the good guys and hurt the bad guys. But upon further review, we started getting very concerned about all of these proposals, and we pulled them all. And we basically said the current film allowance, as it stands, is going to stay in place. And others had wanted to make changes, and we felt we needed to do a major review in this area. We need to make sure that if we want to use a tax system in order to encourage film, that we actually encourage film. And two, that we're actually encouraging jobs for local people. And when we've talked to the industry, they were disappointed in not getting some of the things they wanted, was that we're going to have further engagement with the industry to see what is a good way to assist the industry. It might be tax, or it might be something else. And that engagement will be happening over the next couple of months. And now on to administration.
Thank you, Chief. Let's just start off with the so-called pay now, argue later principle. This is something that the Constitutional Court has confirmed. Essentially what it means is that even though you may be disputing an assessment with SARS, SARS can insist that you pay it. Now, SARS insists fairly rarely that when we do insist, we should be paying you interest if it turns out that we were wrong and we have to give you the money back. Now, as it stands at the moment, we will pay you interest if this all happens after you have appealed against the decision that we've made, but it doesn't apply if this happens a bit earlier in the process when all you've done is you have what's known as an objection, or in, if you're a legal person, an internal appeal. Now, that seems unfair. So what is happening in this particular set of proposals is three things, and that's the last three bullets there. We're clarifying that payment is not suspended by an objection, so right from the beginning of the process. Then what we're doing is something that we haven't had in the law before, is we've put a set of guidelines in as to when SARS will insist on your paying. You're not able to provide security, it looks like you're busy getting rid of the assets as fast as you can, things like that. Alternatively, forcing you to pay the money means that you in fact are going to jeopardize the existence of a business or something of that nature. Those are all factors that are now formalized in the legislation. And then finally, we make sure that you will always be paying interest if SARS gets it wrong and in fact insists on you paying something and it later turns out that you shouldn't have had to. So that is that slide and that proposal. The next one is somewhat linked. It's about disputes again. SARS was given the power to settle disputes. Now the question is, when do we settle that dispute? At the moment, the law is perhaps slightly unclear, so what we're saying is we can only settle that dispute once an assessment has been raised. You can't do it before an assessment. Why is that important? Well, it's quite important because there's some fairly strict reporting requirements about these settlements, both to the Minister and to the Auditor General, to make sure that these settlements are appropriate. And this just means that we have better control over the settlements that are entered into. Then back to provisional tax, which we've touched on already. This is quite a busy slide, so let me keep relatively simple. Last year, we introduced a new rule for what is known as the second provisional payment. For those of you who are provisional taxpayers, this is old news. If you're not, quick recap on how the provisional tax system works. There are three payments that you need to make. The first one, as an individual, is 6 months into the year. The second one is at the end of the year. And then there's what's known as the third or top-up payment, which happens 7 months after the end of the year. And last year we said that, well, what needs to happen is by the second payment, so remember that's the one at the end of the year, your estimate has got to be within 80% of what is finally assessed for you. Okay, so there's a 20% margin of error. People felt that was too rigid, it was too tough, especially on smaller taxpayers. So essentially what we're doing here, and it's being proposed in this set of legislation, is that we go back for smaller taxpayers to the old system, where there was essentially what was known as the basic amount. And all the basic amount was how you were previously assessed. If you relied on how you were previously assessed to make your estimate, you would not be subject to any penalties. For larger taxpayers, we say the new system sticks, because larger taxpayers have got the kind of records, the kind of expertise to allow them to make more accurate estimates. And then one other thing that deals with employees and employers. All of you have probably seen SARS's new e-filing system where, in fact, we fill in what your salary was on your tax form for you. Okay? And the reason we're able to do that is because we get information from the employers that tells us what they paid the people that work for them. Now, as it stands at the moment, employers only reconcile what they've deducted from their employees with what they've paid over to us once a year. That is not ideal. You should, strictly speaking, do that more frequently. Ideally, you do that once a month. But that may be too frequently from an administrative burden point of view. So the idea is that the commission will be able to request employers to reconcile more frequently, and the plan there is to do it twice a year going into the future, and then once that is bedded down, to move to once every 3 months. But that is future planning. What the legislation does, it merely creates the mechanism for that kind of reconciliation to happen more frequently than once a year. And we're now in the closing part of the presentation. Value-added tax, biometric information. The VAT system is incredibly popular around the world. It's a fairly recent tax that has exploded across the world. It's now pretty much every major economy except the US has got a value-added tax system. One of the problems with the VAT system, though, is that if you are criminally inclined, you can use it to get refunds of money that you haven't paid. So, for example, what you can do is you can pretend that you have exported goods outside the country and then claim a VAT refund for the goods that you have exported, fictitiously exported. Now, that is an ongoing problem. Last year, SARS, in fact, streamlined our registration processes to try and make them easier for people, and what we found was then people promptly turned around and started abusing the easier registration process so that they could, in fact, get into the system and claim these fictitious refunds. So we've been forced to tighten up again. And one of the aspects that we're considering going into the future is the use of things like fingerprints to identify who the responsible person is when they make an application for registration. So that if it turns out that they are fraudulent, it's just that much easier to find them later. And then the final aspect that I'd just like to touch on in this presentation deals with customs modernization. This is a very big project at SARS. There's a new Customs Act on its way one of these days, so you're going to have a nice thick piece of legislation to look at perhaps next year. And the idea here is that legislation dates back to 1964. The trading, international trade has changed dramatically since then. Now, what do we do in that bridging period when we are moving from the old legislation to the new? The answer is in this particular set of provisions in the bills, which essentially say that the commissioner is able to make rules to deal with that transition from the old to the new. They must be temporary rules. They must be, and as it says there, they must be urgently required, and we mustn't be able to effect the necessary amendments in the current legislation in time to make it happen. And then we can essentially tweak the existing rules in the legislation to deal with that transitional period. And then just to ensure that you have control and we don't get too enthusiastic with what we do, those rules lapse unless ratified by Parliament. And that is my part of the presentation done. Thank you.
Are there any other parts to be added? Just one thing about traveling. I'm in the Northern Cape. When I drive to my constituency, I can't fly. I must drive there. And during the election and elections and by-elections, you do it in a year between 50,000 and 60,000 kilometers. So in a certain sense, we in that province are forced to drive more. Because about the question of logistics, there's not a plane flying from Kimberley to Springbok. It's 804 kilometers that you're sitting for a whole day to get to your destination. It's 1,315 from Alexander Bay to Norgelspont, and then you're still in the same province. Just to give us a picture. Model machine.
Yeah, Chair, I've got actually a question of clarification that I just want to know how much time do you need to consider this particular bills? How much time do we have to look into this? Because I've got I just got a sense through the presentation. I may have missed the introduction, but I'm not sure whether I've missed a lot. Is that since I've been listening, it definitely just talks to people that work from different levels or people that are doing business from different levels. But I haven't really had much talking to our different geographical areas in the country, especially in relation to our priorities. When we talk about rural development and whatever, anything that seeks to be talking to that, to encourage that, and limiting movement of people from rural areas to urban areas and all that. I haven't heard anything. So one would have had a serious interest of looking to these, probably even coming up with certain refinements of certain amendments that have been brought in here to talk to our priorities, our national objectives. Thank you.
Well, Mashida, yes, when we started the meeting, I said that I had interaction with the chairperson of the NCP, Honorable Shlangu, regarding the period we have to deal with this legislation. Normally, we get 3 days under normal circumstances before we table our report in the House. In this case, we are having our meeting this afternoon, and it must be tabled, the report must be tabled tomorrow afternoon in the plenary. I had a lengthy discussion with the Honorable Mashlangu. Because there was hearings that was held by the Standing Committee in the National Assembly, and we could have been notified to be linked up with that exercise, to go through it, to get also the picture of the roles players and stakeholders out there. But that didn't happen. So I indicated also to the Honorable Chairperson of Slangu that I think this is the last time we will be dealing with this in this fashion. If I don't think it's correct, I would have liked to have this presentation a day or three before to go through it. But that is now history. Your question is very relevant regarding our national objectives. How is this legislation going to affect that? What government wants to do? What is the implication of this in terms of the strategic objective? How will it assist rural development, agricultural development, housing, etc.? Because we're actually speaking of the poor people. What will be the effect of this? My mind tells me yes, a bigger income for the state, revenue. To get what we are supposed to get. But I don't want to elaborate on that.
Chair, because you have answered my first question, you have already registered my concern if we have to actually table this report tomorrow. And because, Chair, as we have been crying about the rural development, we are having, you know, it's the people getting their land back through claims, and then we are saying the government must assist them to actually work out the land. But then, are those people subjected to the same taxation laws like everybody else? It can't be correct, Chair. It can't be correct when people are crawling on their legs. Yes, the land is given back to them. It is on their name as property owned. But these people, they are not yet ready to comply to the current taxation laws that we have. Now, this proposal needs to be talking to that, encouraging those guys. We're talking about pilot projects of rural development, and now those companies or whatever that will be involved, either in construction, whatever, but trying to develop those areas like the Giana area, like the Rimfast map, whatever. For some reason, something needs to be thought in terms of this kind of exercise, because it wouldn't be any firm that would like to go all the way and try and assist government to establish these human settlements that we're trying to do, to try and avoid people moving from the far rural areas into urban areas. And then we are expecting people to build malls in the far rural areas, markets in the rural areas, to develop those areas as well equally. But then people wouldn't like to go, because there are a lot of risks to go there. And there must be some sort of a trade-off. But this is not talking to those things right through from the beginning until to the end. And I'm definitely convinced that we are missing our national priorities. We may have touched it on one end, but we are missing the real national priorities that we need to encourage and for that to happen for the good of all the people of this country. Thank you.
You captured the question.
Thanks, Chair. In terms of the global tax position, and by that I mean in South Africa, obviously, there's tax cuts of 4.5 million overall, but within that is an increase in the general fuel levy of 5 billion, almost 5 billion. I'm quite amazed to see that increase in the context of the economic downturn. And if you could just explain or qualify that a little bit. And then further on that point, did Treasury or SARS ever look at the possibility of using tax breaks to defend the economy in the face of the recession in terms of targeting areas where you could stimulate the economy? I believe the UK dropped VAT, for example, for a period. I believe economies like Chile have done it as well, have introduced targeted tax breaks. The film industry issue, I understand it's complex, but it sounds to me as if there was some fraud taking place and you've therefore cancelled the entire scheme, and does that not prejudice a whole lot of people who may have been justifiably creating jobs and benefiting from the existing scheme? And if you are going to be reviewing it, how long will that review take? Because I'd imagine it's a sector which depends on this type of tax relief. And then, Chair, we've just come from a plenary now where the House passed a motion calling for the extension of the deadline, this Friday's deadline, because of the strike last week. I understand SARS issued a statement today saying that they wouldn't be extending the deadline. But in that statement, they also said that SARS, because there's so much demand at SARS offices, they're going to be staying open later every night. So now, if there is so much demand, and you must admit, or that SARS must admit that that's linked to, in no small way linked to the strike last week. Surely there must be some flexibility in terms of that deadline for Friday. And then lastly, when these proposals were on the table, was there any work done on the fiscal decentralization? And if there was, can you comment on that? Thank you.
Chair, thanks, Chair. Mine is on a personal income tax table. I say here from zero up to 122,000 is 18% for each rent. Can we get my clarity there? Thanks.
Got a number of questions, really, and also, I suppose, some of them are comments, but the increase in the medical aid amounts are really not significant enough as compared with the actual medical aid costs. Is there any way that one could increase that? I think it's, what's it gone up to now, 500 or 600 or something, so whatever it is. I mean, would this really have a significant impact on revenue income if that were increased to be more in line with what the market costs of those are? In terms of the doing away with the deemed travel for motor vehicle allowances or travel allowances, the onerous, the keeping a logbook is an onerous business. And inevitably, people are not going to keep a logbook and are going to then be faced with the choice of losing the claim or fraudulently making up a logbook after the fact. Surely, under those circumstances, we don't want to create criminals. Why don't we leave the deemed in place? I know that you are suggesting that there's a lot of fraud taking place, but one of the positions that we should be looking at is not penalizing people for the acts of those who are not acting lawfully. And that's essentially what we're trying to do. Well, not what we're trying to do, but what effectively we do by removing the deemed provision. In terms of the lump sum payment, there's been a lot of concern about this. The 300,000 you can now draw in terms of a job loss. I would assume that's on retrenchment. You did mention dismissal, I think, and so if you're dismissed for disciplinary problems, you can then go and withdraw your lump sum benefit or a part thereof, which I think is probably bad policy. But just clarify that for me, please. In terms of the existing 30,000 exemption, where there is a retrenchment and the employer pays out, if I remember correctly, there's a 30,000 exemption. That remains in place, I hope. So I see you nodding, Keith, so I assume that answers my question very quickly. In terms of the divorces prior to 13th of September 2007, I'm not 100% sure exactly what the implications they are, but there were implications in terms of withdrawals by one of the divorced spouses versus the member. If you could just explain what the final position there is. Okay, in terms of learnerships, my experience with learnerships is that it's, as you said, a very onerous thing, and so people just don't make use of them. And now you're saying you've simplified it, but one of the most onerous things was to set up the learnership program itself, not so much the actual claim for the deduction. And unless that's simplified, are you expecting it to be more widely used without that being simplified? Or has it been simplified? The dividend tax, is it going to be 10%? I'm reading your thing and I see that 10%, but or is it going to be added to the shareholder's normal taxable income? Because then revenue is going to score tremendously, because very few people who earn dividends are earning or paying less than about an average tax rate of 28% or something. So you know, the taxes, you guys are going to score. Well, who's you guys? Maybe I'm you guys as well. And where I sit at the moment, which hat I'm wearing as a taxpayer. You're creating the possibility of kind of joint ventures between publicly owned or state-owned, municipal-owned property and privately owned improvements and the deduction by the generator of the improvements. Why has that been restricted, or has it been restricted, simply to land owned by the state or municipality? Why is it not possible for two private joint ventures to do it? If it is, please, then it's an easy answer as well, a nod of the head, perhaps. Moving private property from trusts, particularly, do you foresee that that's actually going to happen? Because invariably, private property held in trusts is held there for estate duty purposes, or what death, whatever it's called now. And so I would envisage that 2-year gap you're offering may not be as widely used as perhaps you hope it will, because if they do, it simply puts it back into the estate, and if it exceeds the 3.5 or 7 million, it becomes taxable. The pay now, argue later. How much discretion is SARS going to be given here? I mean, if there's an assessment that is patently incorrect and the taxpayer is simply not able to pay the kind of money that is being demanded, how much discretion is SARS going to have under this provision? Your provisional tax two-tier system at 1 million rand is far too low. There are many, many businesses out there which can exceed 1 million rand, but they're one-man shows who really don't have the accounting systems that will enable them to do the estimates as accurately as 80%, and I foresee that in time you guys are going to close down on that and it'll be 85%. Perhaps a bit more in time. So I'm cautious about that 1 million. I'm not questioning the two tier, but I am suggesting that 1 million perhaps is not the right figure. In terms of your employee, you're putting a huge burden on small businesses when you're suggesting we go into a quarterly EMP 501 recon. I think that we're really going the wrong way there. I don't see what the benefit is. You need to motivate that one to me. It's just putting another huge burden on employers, and therefore you'll get the tax consultants or the bookkeepers making more money as these poor guys have to now outsource this function. And many of them already outsourcing because the electronic submission is fantastic, but you need to know what you're doing. To the normal small businessman who's a hands-on fellow making furniture or whatever, computers and that kind of thing, it's not their forte. But I do concede it's a fantastic system. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Honourable Gunga. Thank you.
On slide 10, the last bullet point, it is proposed that this threshold be increased to 120 in view of recent increases in the tax level for those 65 and older. Just give us a clarity on that, and the one on top, the bullet point one also on that same slide. And then I've been covered by the medical aid question. Yes, I think it's slide 12. It doesn't show, but it says the travel model legal allowance. The chairperson asked a question concerning the kilos that have been traveled in the Northern Cape. If you were an MPL, you traveled about 60,000 kilos. And out of those 60,000 kilos, about 40,000 of them will be about official traveling just to positions you work. The chairperson asked that question. I would like you to just give us an explanation
on that because I've seen somewhere in your presentation it says the first 18,000 cages are being taken as official, as private, and the others will be official, something like that, from just vice versa. And then on the next slide also there, okay, now I've been covering that one, let me just see. Yes, pre-retirement lump sum benefits. Slide 15. Can you just explain to us that, please? Thank you. Am I finished now? Lump sum benefits. Okay, I've been covered by the lump sum. Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Johnny? I want to remind honourable members, when we became members of Parliament, we had to complete forms for the pension fund we belonged to. One of the forms had a heading, your beneficiaries. I hope you completed that form. Because that refers to what the Treasury told us. How are you going to buy your, what you are going to leave behind? If you're 10 years and more in Parliament, you're going to get a few million back. And if you've got your wife and you've got four or five children, you will have to make it at least divided in terms of what Treasury just told us. So just caution you to relook at it.
So we can refill it in again?
Yes, you can do it. I'll supply it to you because the people at the pension fund.
just additions, Chair. I think they're just two small items. Chair, I think for the past 2-3 years, I think there was this talk of integrating or equaling the pension age of male and female for pension purposes, and I think that there was a little bit of a drop on the pension age of men, but now this threshold on provisional tax and the rest still talking to 65 years, is it correct? Don't we need to adjust to the current age of pension? I think there was a decision in the past year that it was around 62 or 63, something like that, going towards equalization of men and women. I think these tables maybe need to talk to that. And the other one that I just wanted to add, Chair, is we have been hearing from finance or treasure of the intent to simplify tax returns. Are these taxation amendment laws actually still taking us towards that our tax returns will be more simple, you know, to complete and an account? Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Bunda, a follow-up, and after that, Treasury will then respond.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. On this slide 36, the interest pay now calculator, and I'm putting this question to Sasno. The third bullet point on the 6A, it is proposed that this act be amended to clarify that payment is not suspended due to objection. There are all those three bullet points I need you to explain to me. The reason why I'm asking this, pay now calculator, as an employee, does the onus rest on you as the employee to rectify the mistake that the employer has made on your IFP5, or does that onus rest on the employer? If SAS gives you an explanation, this is what's supposed to be happening, this is what's supposed to be on your IFP5, and the employer differs from that, and the employer says, no, it's not supposed to be like that, it's supposed to be like that. So let me just take an example. Members of Parliament are getting traveling allowance, excluding the car allowance. For instance, if a member travels from here they're not using the voucher, they travel from here to Kimberley or Uppington or wherever they travel. It's the one voucher that they can claim those kilos. Now, I think it's the code 3702 and a 3703. Explain that to us, because this is where the argument comes. Pay now, argue later, and argue later. And the problem there is that many of the members or anybody outside there who are in that bracket will have a problem with this amendment. Thank you.
Any more questions? No? Please answer it. It's a few pages, I think, but proceed.
I must say I'm very impressed by the questions, especially in this hour. It's very impressive. I'm very, very impressed.
We are very vigilant, I can tell you that. What
I'm going to do is I'll answer some, I'll pass it to Franz, and I'll pass it back, and we'll try to get through them. But we'll try to make sure we answer all the questions. Let me just deal with some basic things first, because, again, this is the first time we're dealing with the committee. It's important to notice something, that we're only amending these acts. These are the acts that are currently sitting there. These are amendment acts, and I think it's important to know that we're amending this every year. We used to do it twice a year. We're trying to reduce it to it's once a year. So a lot of things might not be addressed because they already exist in the law as it stands today. And a lot of the questions sort of relate to that, what is currently existing. We're only amending certain things here, and that's what we're doing every year. One of the difficulties for you as the committee is that if you look at the bill, you're amending the bill. It's very hard to read the bill. In order to read the bill, you have to have one of these with you. And one of the things that we tried to do is we've had the explanatory memorandum so you can see a little better what's going on, because it's always an amendment of a core bill. Whereas most of your other bills, you'll see your standalone pieces. And that is one of the difficulties in income tax, because you're just amending it. All these acts you're amending all the time. Now, having said that, let's just go through a few things. Let's first turn to this table, which I think is very important. And that is how this table works on page 8, on slide 8. Because there was a question about that, and it sort of fed into the 0 through 122 question. Because I think the question was, gee, if I earn 1 rand, you're taking 18%. And it doesn't work that way, but I can see why you read it that way. The way your income tax goes on slide 8 is that you have these things called rebates, which are translated into thresholds. So for your purposes, forget those rebates. What first happens is, let's just look at 209-210, so it's on the right side. If you make up to 54,200, it's exempt. So that way a lot of poor people are simply out of the system. Once you earn more than 54,200, you fall into the table. So when you see the table 0 to 132, you have to quietly add in 54,200. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, but that's basically how it works. So your zero is your first zero beyond 54,200. Now, why does the tables have to be done this way? Well, because tax people, we got to make things complicated for you. So we do, so you have to ask these questions. But the bottom line is your first 54,200 is exempt. Once you go beyond 54,200, then you're hitting in the 18% bracket. So it's really zero. You have to think add 54,200 throughout. Then what the question was is, what is these numbers? What we were trying to do is simplify it for you. You see, your first, once you move beyond 54,200, the next 0 to 132 is taxed at 18%. Then when you go beyond 132 to 210, that next chunk is the 25%. But you saw 23,760 plus 25. The 23,760 represents the total amount of 18% times 132. So we're trying to actually simplify it for you there. So that, like, if you earn, let's say, 600,000, the way you would do it on the table, let's say you earn 654,200, just to give a number. Yes? It's annual. every year. It's annually. Okay, yeah, he liberated jumped in. Let me finish my example, then hopefully he can save me from there. If it's 654,200, if you make 654,200, the 54,200 is exempt. Then the 600,000, you go to the table. You know? Am I making a mistake? Yeah, okay, I'm making a mistake. Okay.
It is all built into the table. So if you earn 625,000 rand,
yeah.
Okay, just to make my sum that I'm about to do very easy. Okay, at 625,000 rand, all you would do is you'd look at the table and you'd say, okay, on the first 525,000 rand, SARS has already worked it all out for you.
Yeah.
All I have to, I pay on that first 525,000, 152,960.
Yeah.
Okay. On the next 100,000, I pay 40,000. Okay, that takes me up to the 625,000 that I've got. Okay? So that gives me, what's it, 192,960 rand that I have to pay over. And then, and this is where Keith, on 600,000 rand. And then you get your rebate, which is the 9,756 that you can deduct as a discount. Think of it that way.
Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. That was my concern. When I read it this thing, I read it the way you explained it now. Now comes the question. In other words, a person that is in the bracket of 625,000 is actually earning 400,000 in the year.
Come on, members, order. Let Treasury please answer your questions. Follow up? I show you.
So the whole point in the table, I was trying to do it with the threshold, that's what I was trying to do, but anyway, fine. But the point, what I was just trying to say here, look, one of the things that's very important in these tables, and that's the point that you're raising is that how much of that salary is going to tax? And what's important is you're trying to make sure that over the years, we've been trying to push up these brackets so that these numbers are more and more favorable on this table. In order to do that, you've got to collect taxes elsewhere. You've got to get the money elsewhere. So one of the things that you have to discuss is when you look at things, you say, look, this table, like the amount you heard, you said, gee, that's a lot of money. Now, it's a lot better than it used to be because we've been adjusting the tables. However, if you start giving away a lot of tax incentives and a lot of tax relief to other parties, this table starts getting affected in a negative way. And this is the part of the table that's very important that we don't discuss usually. Usually all the taxpayers and the standing committee proceedings that you weren't there, they don't care about the tables. They care about all these other incentives. But what happens is you give that away, these tables get tougher. And so you've got to understand there's a trade-off. And the other trade-off you have to understand, and this goes back to some earlier questions of what we were doing here, tax is only one tool of government. The other one is spending. Government has a lot of spending priorities. Now, government's got to get the money somewhere. So it's got to come out. You either raise taxes or you borrow more. Now, one thing that has been done over the number of years is we've been trying to borrow less because while borrowing feels good in the time you borrow it, then you pay off. The example I give is people who buy an expensive car that they can't afford. It's fun that first day when you drive it off the lot, but then every month you're paying, and then that car isn't so much fun anymore. And that happens to a lot of people. Now, one of the things that the government has been trying to do over the number of years is reduce the borrowing, and we're trying to distribute the tax fairly. But then the money also has to be used, and so it's got to be used for social grants, for instance. That's a very important priority. Other things are infrastructure in order to promote the economy. And what the minister was doing as the economy was getting into trouble, one of the things that he announced in the speech, and we were very aware of this, was he was trying to promote a lot of the pumping of the prime, so to speak, in difficult economic times on the spending side. The reason why he's focusing on the spending side is that tends to help the lower income more. If you're looking at tax, especially the income tax, adjustments here help the higher, the wealthier more. Because a lot of people are below the 54,000. They're below the threshold. So they need to be helped. What you need to do is create jobs. And a quicker stimulus is what he called shovel-ready projects. So that was the balancing that we had. Now, some argue that we should give in more tax cuts. The problem is you give more tax cuts, you're going to have to borrow more. And that'll feel good for this year. But then, at the time we have to borrow more, we're going to have to pay it back. And so what the minister was trying to do is make that balance. And that was what he was thinking in, basically, in February. The balance was more on the spending side. Now, understand also that over the last number of years, really since I've been here, about 8 years now, you have seen tax cut after tax cut affecting these tables. In prior years, it was much more generous. So we've had a continuous push in this direction. As running money is getting tighter, now you're trying to figure out what to do, and government also has a lot of projects that they want to do. And you'll see there's a lot of priority programs going on. And the question is where to put that money. And I think what the minister was seeing is that there was more of a push on the spending side. And so here we had to be more careful on the tax side. And that's the balance that we always have to keep in mind. As a general matter of those issues.
Just as a matter of interest, on the proportion that you're paying over as tax, I just quickly did some rough sums, and you'll also find it in the budget review at the bank. But to take the person who earns 132,000 rand, okay, which is somebody who has a job in South Africa and is not doing particularly well off. Ah, yes, but there's the difference. Now, that person is paying tax of 14,000 odd rand. After the rebate. And that means they're paying just over 10% of their salary over for tax. And they're retaining 90%. The person who earns 625,000 rand, who's doing pretty well in the South African context, is paying 29% of it. So they're paying 182,400 rand. 29% average rate.
To those whose age are 65 and above.
65 and above, you get a higher rebate, so that you get the additional 5,400 rand off your tax bill. So someone over 65 pays slightly less tax than someone under 65. Okay. So if you have a look at the thresholds, somebody below the age of 65 can earn up to 54,200 without paying any tax. Someone who is 65 and older can earn 84,200 rand without paying any tax at all.
I just want to caution members, we are in for a surprise as we sit here regarding our own tax. So you will have to go and do your arithmetic, your accounting. There's an accountant sitting there at the back. There's a financial advisor sitting in front of me. We will have to do it. Someone else is not going to do it for us. We will have to initiate it to prepare yourself for what might be coming. Honorable Chair,
I just wanted to, just simply to understand, you know, I don't have any fear of numbers, Chair. Numbers are things that I usually enjoy. But I just want to understand the progression of the rates in relation to the fixed amount of tax. Especially when, I would say if we look at the last one, where we're talking about the 525,000. And then you're saying the fixed amount, which actually comes from the top line, the 152,960, it's related to the above bracket. And then plus anything above 525. Now, on the 410,000 to 525,000, if you have the progression from 410 to 525, on the increase on those on the extra tax that needs to be paid, and you compare it with the next one of 525,000 and above, probably there is a point where those two people, after tax, they may be taking the same amount home.
Thanks, I've just finished making my statement.
No, Chair, I just want to request. See, the first round, a lot of questions were raised. And some has only responded to one and they're stuck. There are so many that they still have to respond. Can they respond first to all the questions and all the follow up questions will come? Otherwise, you're going to stay on this slide until tomorrow. Yeah, no, it is. That's what I'm saying. Answer all these other questions and then we can come back and get started.
Yes. Yes. Well, did you
have
the last question? That's
for our peace. Yes. Since we're on this slide, I want to honorable this is your future as well. Listen to this thing and read this thing properly. On this tax system here, as it is here, in other words, whatever you travel extra and you claim to a certain amount, you also tax that money the same way. Let me explain this way. A person in a legislature will travel 65,000 kgs a year. Of the 65,000, 45,000 of them are official. Now, he's claiming that money. He's been taxing. They tax that money while he's traveling when they pay him. He's been taxing. And then SARS come back afterwards and said, you've been taxed wrong. And they add some extra money. He said, you still owe SARS 84,000. What are you doing with that? That's why I'm asking that question. Pay now, argue later.
Honourable members, let Treasury answer all your questions that you posed.
Let me, Franz wants to answer the current ones. I can see that, so I'm happy to have him do so. I was trying to do something with that table, whatever. The bottom line, though, this table is very important. We don't spend enough time at this table. That's why I don't mind these questions. Because really what's important for your constituency is this table. The bottom line is one of the things that you'll need to look at is that threshold. That threshold is the rebate. I was trying to work it out through the threshold. But the point is you want that threshold to be high. And you want those brackets, the 18% brackets, and the 25% brackets to be assisted as much as you can. And if you don't do that, you'll find that the poorer people are going to be suffering a disproportionate burden on tax. The other thing to keep in mind is the VAT, which is 14%. And you don't want to see that go up. Now, the VAT has special zero ratings for things, goods that the poor utilize, such as pilchards. So these things are important. It is a constituency that is not there, and it is worthy of a discussion. Let me just say one thing that was raised about the rural versus the urban. I wasn't privy to that debate, but there are things that deal with some of these issues. We know that there is land reform. There are currently existing proposals, currently existing law that encourages and assists that conversion. Typically, if you had an expropriation or forced conversion, it would be taxable events. And what we've done is we've said these kind of conversions to assist poor will not be taxable. And we put in some special rules to make sure the tax was not an added cost on these conversions. The other issue, again, is a lot of the rural poor, remember, are falling very low on these thresholds. One thing that we did spend on, you weren't there, but 2-3 years ago, was on banking cooperatives. And banking cooperatives are also designed to assist poor. And basically, what we've given them is small business relief, which effectively allows them to be generally exempt the way they operate. So there are a number of things. One of the issues that is there is, do you have a tax system that is promoting location to encourage you to stay in the rural areas and encourage you to go to the cities? We have one proposal on urban development zones that's designed to encourage investment in urban development zones. That is in the law currently. We've enhanced it slightly in the amendments. But one issue that has not been fully discussed before the committee is, what do you want geographical push? Now, the tax system is really trying to be neutral. It's trying to say, look, wherever you are, the tax system is the same. However, if you're low income, we're trying to provide relief. And that's generally what we're trying to do in the system as we have it. Anyway, Franz on the card.
Great. Lighter vehicles. Just bear in mind, if you're traveling 60,000 kilometers a year, the deeming provision doesn't help you very much because it maximizes, the way it works is the first 18,000 are deemed to be private. From 18 to 32 are then business, and then over 32 is deemed to be private again. So if you're a person who travels large distances, you should be keeping a logbook, and you should be keeping it today. You should not be trying to rely on the deemed kilometer basis. So that's the one aspect. The other aspect is, well, why don't we just keep the deemed travel basis? Well, the fact of the matter is because it doesn't really relate to anything. It's a simplifying assumption that can have absolutely no bearing on reality. So, for example, I, as someone who lives in Johannesburg but works in Pretoria, am able to claim some of my private travel as business travel on the deeming basis because I simply travel enough kilometers that I get over the 18,000 per annum, which is my deemed private, and therefore anything over 18,000 now automatically becomes business. No fraud involved whatsoever. I'm simply relying on the deeming provision. But it makes no sense because somebody who lives in Pretoria and works in Pretoria can't claim those travel from work to business and from home to business and back again at the end of the day. So the problem with the deeming provision is that it sort of stands on its own and it gives a benefit that in fact may have absolutely no relationship to what is actually happening in an individual's life. And in fact, it's impacted merely by where they stay, rather than anything that they are doing. On the logbook side, I mean, SARS does try to assist on this one. We in fact have an official SARS logbook that we publish and allow people to use to try and make things a bit easier for them. I think the problem here is everyone's gotten used to the deemed provision, and that's one of the reasons why over a period of time, that initial 18,000 once upon a time used to be 12,000, then it became 14,000, then it became 16,000, then it became 18,000, was to try and signal to people that, yes, this is something that can't continue. And again, if you look at the slides, you'll see who benefits from this particular allowance and how much. I mean, the cost of this particular allowance is immense. I mean, it rivals pension funds. I mean, this, if you have a look at it, your deductions for current pension fund contributions, the number of taxpayers who are claiming them in that first table, 1.5 million, the amount they're claiming per taxpayer is 7,900 Rand. Travel expenses, 517,000 people are claiming them, but they're claiming 35,000 Rand per taxpayer on this. In fact, people are claiming more on motor vehicle allowances, those who are claiming them, than they offer pension on average. I mean, this is a very, very substantial amount of money that is being allocated, and in the case of the deeming allowances, is being allocated for perhaps business and perhaps not. The fact of the matter is we don't know because it's deemed. I hope that deals with I think that covers the motor vehicle ones. Do you want to go on the next?
No, I think the point, though, just one other minor point, is that most people should not be claiming any motor allowance. They're just driving to and from work. Your situation is unique, but when I heard you, you knew very well where you were driving. You could actually do the logbook in your head when I'm listening to you. The point is that your typical person, you know, they might have the occasional meeting outside of their office, but most of the time they're driving to and from work, and they shouldn't be getting any car allowance at all. And the point is that has a big impact on the table, because what you're doing is you're putting money basically into this car allowance where that money should go ahead instead be adjusting the table, maybe adjusting the rebate so the rebate is higher, or adjusting the general thresholds. So while it looks like that allowance is some free benefit for some people, effectively that means we have less revenue and we're not adjusting the tables properly. And you don't want to distort the tables. So, again, everything has a cost. It's not free money. You know, it doesn't just grow on trees, so to speak. So, now, some other issues that came up, and I think there's other very important issues here. One was the issue on the fuel levy. And this is actually a very difficult issue. And again, one of the things that we're struggling with now is this is environment. And even this is part of the car commuter point. We don't want to encourage overuse of the car. Because, again, that's one of the reasons why our carbon emissions in this country is so high is because of the cars. And you'll see efforts to change that. One, we're trying to improve the roads. That helps. But two, the Hautrain. Trying to improve maybe public transport and not encourage people. Now, people say the fuel levy was part of that in order to encourage people not to be so fuel consumption. Now, the fuel levy is adjusted generally for inflation. What happened was we let it fall behind inflation, and we had to catch up. And there's a big debate on the fuel levy because on the one hand, you're trying to discourage wasteful consumption. And some people say, well, the fuel levy has no impact on fuel consumption. It turns out the fuel is somewhat elastic, that if you raise the cost of fuel, people do use their cars less. They do use more efficient car use. It doesn't happen in year one, but it does happen over the course of several years. And when things get out of control, it goes the other way. A good example is the United States. When fuel became very cheap, 4x4s became very, very popular. When fuel went crazy about a year ago, everybody wanted to get rid of those things. And it took a little bit of time, but there was an adjustment. And the question was here is we were trying to make sure to bring the fuel levy back in line with inflation, having not adjusted it over several years. The problem with the fuel levy, though, is it does disproportionately impact the poor. Because they pay more in relative to their salaries. And the other problem also is it affects people even who are going in the taxis because it raises the taxi fares. And we're going to have to balance that because, unfortunately, many pro-environmentally friendly policies have an anti-poor effect. And how we balance that, I'm not so sure. But, again, that's what we were doing in this round. We were merely catching up with inflation. Just the other one that also is a general issue is on the medical aid. The medical costs was adjusted several years ago. And what we did with the medical aid is there used to be a two-third, one-third formula. For every 900 Rand you paid into your medical aid, you got a 600 deduction. What we found, though, is that formula was favoring more expensive plans. And what the theory was 2 years ago is to say, what we're really trying to subsidize is your hospital cover. Because the wealthier people can afford the more comprehensive plans. The poorer people can only afford no cover or hospital cover. And the questions that keep coming up between the Department of Health and Treasury is, how do you share healthcare services? And if it was seen that we were helping the rich too much in this, it was trying to help more the middle class, and so that cover is more designed at that entry level. Once you start moving beyond that cover, then you don't get a deduction anymore. But there's a lot of pros and cons in this debate, and some people would argue, the Department of Health has been arguing, that there should be no deduction for medical cover at all, and that really all of that money should be going to the health industry, I mean directly toward public spending. Not sure if Treasury goes that far, but those debates go around. Again, we've settled on health cover at this point. And the only adjustment we made was in line with that. The problem that you're disagreeing with is the underlying policy. And again, it just depends where you sit is where you stand, so to speak. There was an issue about fiscal decentralization. This bill doesn't do much on that. One thing that wasn't discussed is the issue of fuel sharing of a levy. It is in this bill. One of the questions was, should provinces have their own revenue source, or should it rely on government? At one time, we had something called the RSC levy, and the RSC levy was used for the provinces. It was for municipalities. That was very costly. It caused a lot of problems for industry. It was very business unfriendly. Sorry about that. So the point was, that what we did is we eliminated that and then we funded it out of the national revenue. The question was, the provinces want their own levies, and a fuel levy was one of them that they're looking at. We ended up saying that we will give a special formula so that some money is going to be allocated to municipality, not based on ministerial discretion, but by a formula. What? Yeah, but the ministerial does have a discretion in that formula. Yeah. But the key is it's a set formula. Now, one of the issues is how we deal with that, because do you as a taxpayer want to face, and you can do this, if you go to the United States, you can face a national tax, so you got to file to the SARS revenue, then you can face an Eastern Cape tax on your income, and then you can face one even in your local Durban tax. So you could have, if you want to have specific earmarked levies, you could start having three levels of taxes all the way across the front. The problem is that it's very difficult for you as a taxpayer. Now you have to file three sets of forms, and that starts becoming very business unfriendly. And again, we have to balance how we allocate money between the various spheres of government without intruding on taxpayers and forcing them to do many different kinds of forms. And one of the things that was asked and raised was, is this part of an effort to simplify the returns? Is this part of the bill? Now, what you do see at your level is we are trying to simplify tax returns. Part of the reason we got rid of the car allowances for that effect. We are trying to make the income tax for your average employee and your average person simpler. So a pre-populated return. So that less and less has to be done on that end. And that's less of an interface that gets involved. Now, the problem is simplicity and fairness are at crossroads. If you want more deductions because you think it's fair, well, then that makes it more complicated. It means you've got to file more returns. If you want simplicity, you get one result. If you want this perfect, I get a deduction for every little cost I have, it goes another way. At the end of the day, we've been moving toward a simplicity where we'd rather adjust it into the rates. Because at the end of the day, it's fair, and we do think it's simpler that way. I think those are some. Let me let you take over a few, and then I'll take some back.
All right. Just on the film industry, we haven't cancelled the incentive at all. I mean, the incentive stays there as it stood at the beginning of the year. All that has changed is we were going to adjust the incentive. If you go back to the budget review, there were some concerns about some new emerging avoidance structures. Then there was a question of whether we should sweeten the incentive a little more. And at the end of the day, we said, let's do neither. Let's just go back to the drawing board, talk to the right people, and make sure that we're doing the right thing. So the incentive remains as it stood before we started the process. On the question of the deadlines, I've just had a look at the media statement we released. No, we're not extending the deadline. And there's some very interesting statistics that have emerged from that particular press statement. We've only had 71,000 people file manual returns. And that compares to 151,000 people who filed manual returns over the equivalent period last year. So manual returns are a dying breed. And the reason for that is that if you're not someone who can e-file, you come into a SARS branch office and you file over the counter. And we capture it there and then. And that is counted as e-filing for deadline purposes. So if you can't, you don't have the time to put the piece of paper in our post box by the end of the week, what you're going to need to do is actually come into the office before the 20th of November. And we'll capture it for you over the counter, and that will count as e-filing, and you'll get a 20 November deadline. I think there's a follow-up.
Just quickly, sorry, Ted, with respect, the point the speaker just made, the manual returns are down. You could argue that they're down because people couldn't file them last week because the staff was on strike.
I would suggest that filing a manual return is probably the least... I mean, that's a matter of filling it in at home and dropping it in the box. If anything was going to be impacted by the industrial action that took place, it would be the over-the-counter filing, where, in fact, you're interacting with somebody across the counter. That has now been resolved. I mean, we have our unions have all signed on to the pay offer, and we should be back to normal. In fact, I know we are back to normal. So those are those two. On the question of trusts, and are we going to get people moving properties out of trusts?
Probably not. But there are some people who found themselves in a special purpose trust where the only thing in the trust is the property. And in those cases, that is typically not an estate planning tactic. It was a transfer duty planning tactic, and I would say one that backfired, because we have a court ruling that says that that, in fact, is not an effective mechanism. And we also had a legislative intervention that also says it's not an effective mechanism. So that one was doubly removed from the playing field. So there may still be some people in the trusts. We started off in the proposals looking at companies only, but there was a call for us to extend it to trusts. We have done so, and we'll see what the take-up is. But really here, the primary focus is probably companies. That's where we started. There was a call to extend it. Keith, do you want to take a couple of those points?
Yeah. On the trust, we're going to get rid of some of the trust because of the estate duty. So it isn't just the residential property companies. What the purpose of the estate duty, that a lot of the trusts are created in order to make sure that you get certain benefits while you transfer everything to a spouse. So that will reduce. But I agree with you that there's a lot of schemes out there trying to avoid the estate duty with the trust, and that calls into question the estate duty. Because does this really make sense what we're doing, or do we need to tighten up and make sure that they can't use the trust to get around the estate duty? And that's not an easy matter. Henry VIII tried it, and he didn't succeed, and we've been fighting that battle for the last several hundred years. But I'm an old man. Maybe I can stick it around for another 20 or so on that fight. But there are just some smaller issues now. I'm surprised somebody brought up the pre-2007 divorces. Here's a very esoteric issue that has caused a lot of problems. Let me just explain to people what's going on in there. When you receive your retirement lump sums, there was an old rule that said, here you are, you're married, you have, let's say, $600,000 in the retirement fund. So you enter into a divorce, and one spouse gets half, and the other spouse keeps the other half. Now, what happens under old law was that the spouse who took, let's say the husband had $600,000 in the fund, the wife was going to get $300,000. She would only get that money when he retired. So they were stuck together for all those years. And the whole formula was a mess because the husband's portion grew, but the wife's portion didn't. And then the husband would be taxed, but then he had a right of recovery against the wife. Basically, the old divorce system meant that even though you were divorced, God forbid if you had a pension plan, you were stuck together for the next 40, 50 years. And so there was a change in the financial services rules, in the FSB rules and that sort, as well as in the tax system for the clean break principle. So once you're divorced, you separate the money, the wife lets it grow, you keep your portion, you let it grow, whatever grows, she's going to be taxed on, whatever grows for you, you're taxed on. So that's the clean break, because if you've been through a divorce, you want a clean break. This pre-2007, some of you are laughing, I'm assuming you've been through what I've been through, so you sort of deal with that. Needless to say, the pre-2007 group, it got very complicated in there. And one of the things is there was a series of transitional rules because it was very complicated to work this out. And what was happening was that the wife would get the money immediately, but the husband would still be taxed on it. And then not only that, it would hurt him in this formula because these formulas affect you for the rest of your life. So there was a lot of unhappiness about this, and what we did is we said, not only are you going to get a clean break from each other, but you're going to get a clean break from SARS as well. So anybody who's in the pre-2007 period, if they get a pension payout and they haven't received it yet, and they've been part of a pre-2007 divorce, we just exempted them and pulled them out completely because we just had enough of this old pre-2007 story. So I think the industry, when we spoke to about it, they looked at the law and they said, we've got a problem. Then we explained what they did. They said, you're really doing that? I said, yes, we're really doing that because we don't want to hear about this issue again. And then you raised it. But I'm sure somebody else will. But needless to say, it's a good answer and everybody walks away and it's done. But going forward, if you get a divorce, your spouse will get a portion of your pension. You get your portion. You separate. If they want to waste their money, they get taxed. You want to waste your money, you get your tax. But clean break, clean break. Learnership. There was a little bit of a criticism about the CETA program. There's been some discussion on these issues. We are the tax people. Okay? The CETA program runs the way it runs. Now, some people can make efficient use of it, some can't. I think it is an issue that has to be discussed, because if it is a complicated program, it helps the wealthier employers. How to simplify it, I know, but we have linked it to that, because otherwise we've got no control. We can't just say, well, we'll give you a special deduction for your internal training program. Because how do we control that? You know, every employer says, well, we train people by on-the-job training, which means they just throw the work at them and they're trained. That is not on-the-job training, and we don't want to give an incentive for that. We want to give an incentive for real training. But it is a difficult one. There was an issue about the dividends tax that we were getting a doubling. The new tax is much more taxpayer favorable than the old. The current tax on dividends falls on companies at 10%. The new tax is going to fall on the shareholder. But dividends will only be subject to tax of 10%. So in the new world, let's say you are that 600,000 Rand employee, and you get another 20,000 of dividends. The 20,000 of dividends are not taxed as part of your salary. They're not taxed except for 10%. So it's 10% and that's it. So dividends get treated better than salary from that perspective. There's reasons we do that, but it's, again, an issue. But the tax will not go up, and as a matter of fact, it will go down because the old dividend tax had no exemptions in it, or whatever exemptions it had was very few. The new one has a lot of exemptions, the most important being pension funds. Currently, dividends going to pension funds are taxed at 10%. In the new world, there will be no tax on those dividends. So it was a way of encouraging savings. So I think it's definitely more favorable. Let me just see here. There was a question about public-private on the landlords. Again, we're dealing with an amendment act. Under current law, if you build on someone else's land, and you're a private person and they're a private person, you're both taxable people, when you build on that land, you are entitled to write-offs. You're just not entitled to write-offs under the current law if you build on government or land that is owned by an exempt person. So we're trying to basically level the playing field here. And so the private parties are not hurt in that way.
Just to clarify something, the way it works is the person who owns the land gets taxed because there's an improvement to the land, and the person who made the improvement gets a deduction over a period of the lease. So it's symmetrical. But where the problem crept in was where the person who made the improvement was getting a deduction, but no one was being taxed. And as soon as that happens, there was scope for certain structures, essentially, that people put together. Hence the rule that said you don't get the deduction if the person who gets the improvement is not taxable. And now we have an exception to that anti-avoidance rule. Since I have the microphone, let me continue then. On the pay now, argue later principle, the question of discretion. That discretion exists today. As it exists today, it says the right to receive and recover any tax chargeable under this Act shall not, unless the Commissioner so directs. And that's all it says. So what the factors are that the Commissioner must use are not specified in legislation. They're specified in a 2000 press statement that SARS put out that said there are certain kinds of things we'll look at. If you now look at Clause 13 of the Second Amendment Bill, you'll see the factors are now set out in some detail. So, the Commissioner may suspend payment of the disputed tax having regard to the compliance history of the taxpayer, the amount of tax, the risk of dissipation of assets by the taxpayer, whether the taxpayer is able to provide security, and so on. So it now lists the factors. If a taxpayer is unhappy with the decision, as was the case in Metcash, which went all the way to the Constitutional Court, you have the right of review. In other words, you can ask a court to review our decision as to whether this is have to pay it over to us, and we were wrong, and you get a refund. You will get a refund at interest. And what is interesting, forgive the pun, is that that refund interest is not the usual rate we'll use for refund interest in the income tax world, which is 6.5% today. It in fact is 10.5%. We give you a higher interest rate when we make that refund, because the odds are you probably had to borrow money on overdraft or something of that nature to make the payment to us. So there is an inbuilt disincentive for SARS to in fact force payment where there isn't a reasonable ground for doing so, because we end up paying a higher interest rate than we would normally. On the question of the provisional tax and the 1 million rand taxable income dividing line, when we looked at the numbers, that 1 million rand dividing line picks up 90% of taxpayers, more than 90%, nearly 95% of taxpayers by volume. So by number of taxpayers, by far the majority of people are going to fall into tier one. Of course, being who we are, we had to look at the other side of the equation. So what are that 5 to 10% contributing by way of value? They're contributing just on 90% of the value. So what we have now is tier one, which covers the vast majority of people, and tier two, which then hones in on the relatively small number of taxpayers with over a million rands worth of taxable income, and says, we expect you to be somewhat more financially sophisticated than we'd expect you to get that estimate. Again, remember, that payment needs to be at the end of the financial year, at which point there is still a 20% margin of error. And assuming that you have still got it wrong, there is a discretion for SARS to waive the penalty if you can show us that you made a serious attempt at the estimate and that you weren't doing it negligently or fraudulently. I see a follow-up.
Whether it wouldn't have been better to advise the government to create an environment whereby business could invest more to create jobs and therefore to increase the number of people who are working, who can pay tax? And the other question was, this intended increase in tax, is it to cover the gap of the expected less collection, or is it to increase tax and keep it as normal?
My response with respect to that is this doesn't increase tax at all. All it says is when you pay the tax, because you're going to have to pay the tax either at provisional tax stage or when you are assessed. It just impacts when the tax is paid. So there's no tax increase here. The reason we're doing it is because of the way the old rule worked. It relates to when you were last assessed. Okay, this is now if you're in the second tier, the over 1 million. And what would be happening there is people would either not have put their tax return in, or it would be a very complex tax return. So that last year assessed was a very old year. So let's say that year assessed was 3 or 4 years ago when you had a loss. Now you're a very profitable company. What would then happen is you'd say, I can use the so-called basic amount, which is based on a three-year-old assessment, which has, so I have to pay no provisional tax at all, even though I'm making lots of money this year. And so you would defer the payments that you were making. And this got to be quite a contested terrain between taxpayers and SARS as to what kind of estimates you should be making, whereas the provisional tax system should be fairly automatic. SARS having to argue with you about when you pay your tax shouldn't be that something that happens frequently, hence the change. I should flag that this particular proposal is largely based on something that was put to us by a group of professional associations and taxpayer representatives. So this was something they came up with, which we modified. accepted. So this has a great deal of buy-in from outside an industry. There is a medium-term project which will look at how provisional tax acts more broadly and the way interest works in this area and the way penalties work. But that's something that will take a couple of years because there's some fairly fundamental changes that have been proposed here to us in discussion. That's something that we wouldn't want to spring on people in the course of, well, first of all, that hadn't been announced in the budget review, and second of all, it would require some pretty significant systems changes. Speaking then of systems changes, the question of a quarterly EMP 501, why would we need more frequent reconciliations? It's something that we've encountered now as the economic downturn has begun to bite on employers. It's a phenomenon where people deduct pays you earn from their employees and then delay paying it over to SARS or don't pay it over to us at all. And that's problematic because the employee now doesn't have the money and we don't have the money. The employer's got the money. And it's to keep track of that sort of thing that more frequent reconciliations make sense. And again, I appreciate that this does have a compliance cost attached to it, which is why we're certainly not proposing that next year we'll switch to quarterly. We would want to do this on a phased approach as people are able to handle this kind of change. And again, I'm thankful for the favorable comments that were made about our software, and we'll continue trying to make that software even more user-friendly and usable. Right, what else do I have? I think...
You might have one or two more. I don't know. You might dig them out, but I think you got them. I think the...
One more. There was a question of the 300,000, whether it's on retrenchment or any dismissals, only retrenchment. And there's some specific rules about what kind of retrenchment we're talking about because we don't want the managing director retrenched in inverted commas. So there are rules there that we have used in another context in the Act, which we've now adapted and put in here. So it's for real retrenchments, not any dismissal.
That actually is the point, that you get this 300,000. The 30,000 that was referred to is a provision that this thing is dealing with you taking money out of retirement. The 30,000 is your employer says, here's your severance package, and you get the 30,000 exception there. So that remains separate and it stands as is. That's the issue under discussion for various things, but under the current version, it just stays as is. That's all there is on that one. Just one of the last one that was raised was the 55 to 65. You know, what's the age limits? I think that's another issue that's there. You see, we have different age limits all over the various acts. The question is, should they all be the same? Now, you know, there's sort of two views because a lot of people are living longer and longer. So those people would say, really, and if you hear, you know, it's now more of a Western European kind of thing, they would say that retirement age should be pushed up for both husbands and wives, men and women. Not from 65 down to 60, but it should go from 65 to 70. And a segment of this population is living longer and longer. So should we force people to retire at a certain age? On the other hand, unfortunately, there's a certain segment of the population that is suffering from various illnesses, and they're dying earlier. And so there's a push to drive down the retirement age on that side. We have a dual society here. And I don't know, you know, how these systems resolve it. But the tax system has not caught up with that. And whether it should or not, I'm not sure. But the point is on retirement, what we're trying to encourage people is to save money on that retirement. Now we have to decide what's the right age. And I think that's part of a larger discussion and maybe even part of retirement reform.
I would just make one additional point. As far as retirement is concerned, that can happen from a tax perspective, that can happen from 55 onwards.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're covered there. Yeah. The other question was, you know, the over 65, under 65, the thresholds and so on. Mm-hmm. That is a separate issue that Keith has just touched on.
I don't think I've been understood on that one, Chair, because one was of the opinion that these taxpayers below 65 and above 65, generally in the past has been based on 65 as a pensionable age. Generally. Now the question that I was just raising is that pensionable age has changed from 65 now. They have been coming down. Are these tables not supposed to be talking to that age? That was my little question. Not that whether people retire on a particular age or they die or they refuse to die until 65. I was not talking that. Just talking to the fact that 65 has been identified as a pensionable age, and some of the tax tables, they've been talking to that as people paying tax but being on pension age, and those that are still on active age. Now that age is changing, then are these tax tables not supposed to be adjusted or to talk to the new pensionable age? Thank you.
You've got that question?
Got it. If I could just respond. It's not 65 because it's the retirement age. That has been a coincidence. But if you go back to the history, and it's interesting, I mean, I wasn't around when this happened, but there used to be two sets of thresholds, one that kicked in when you were 60, another that kicked in when you were 70. And again, as part of the idea of simplifying the system, those two were merged and pushed together to the point between the two of them, which was 65. So we could, in fact, go back to the more complex system and have a 60 and a 70. But the idea was to try and simplify matters and merge the two sets of thresholds, and they merged at 65, which was how that number arrived. But it had nothing to do at that stage, as far as I'm aware. And as I say, I wasn't there. I've just done this from a bit of research. There were two original historical sets of thresholds that were merged into one at 65 as the middle ground.
Honourable members, it's 25 minutes to 8. I think we have exhausted our questions. Are there any follow-ups? We've got Advocate Jenkins here as well, legal guru in Parliament. Mr. Jenkins, anything from your side? I see you were capturing there.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Now, the only comments I will have will expose my conflict of interest because I'm a taxpayer as well. I share some of the concerns, but maybe not in a light note, but in a serious note, I was just thinking about this table. I might be out of order, so just tell me if I am. You know, we do get people in this country, and I haven't done the research, I'm just reading too many newspapers lately, who earns in excess of 3, 4, 5 million per year. And I see the tax table stop at, 525. So it's almost as if there's an unfinished story. I just want to throw it out there. Shouldn't it continue? Can't we? And if we are short of revenue and there is a drive internationally to cap certain of these huge payouts for executives. Yeah. But that is clearly an unpopular topic. That's it.
We haven't got people in this room in that bracket, so that I can assure you. Honourable members, no, thank you. Thank you for your cooperation, for your excellent questions you posed. We've got the legislation now in front of us. I don't think, in terms of the questions, the honourable members, are there any amendments you want to make to the Act after the bill as it is? I want to read to you then the committee report that will go to the House. The gentleman sitting there is waiting for to process it. It's on the HC. The Select Committee on Finance and Appropriations, having considered the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill, B10 2009, National Assembly, Section 77, referred to it as classified by the Joint Tagging Mechanism, reports that it has agreed to the bill without amendments. Agreement? Honourable members? Honourable Machine?
Yeah, Chair, I
just want to indicate that we support that statement. On our final resolution of this particular meeting, one just wanted to also propose, Chair, that we seek time with these two gentlemen, or three or four of them, and debate these things seriously, so that the next taxation laws amendment then must be properly informed. Because surely there are many things that we are not agreeing, but we have been hijacked. And because now we don't have time, we can't hold the country at ransom. And that is the spirit that we are, I'm agreeing to this particular. But we must urgently, within a very short space of time, have a serious meeting where we actually talk things and talk sense into SARS and also treasure. Thanks.
Maybe we must have a joint meeting with our colleagues in the National Assembly with such a session and put a day aside for that, that we've got enough time. But I think there's agreement on what Honorable Machine have just said. Honorable members, no, thank you. We noted the concerns. It is on the system here. So it is captured. It's not going to be thrown out of the window. And I will also mention tomorrow when I make the statement on behalf of the committee in the NCOP about the time we have to deal with this legislation that is also on record in Hanjar. Could you wait? That is what the polls are concerned. I'll sound it now. The secretary just passed a note to me. Members must please inform the secretary regarding the visit to the Northern Cape. The what? Yeah. The Select Committee on Economic Affairs, Land and Environmental Affairs, Trade and Industry, Cooperative Governance, and the chairperson of the Select Committee on Economic Affairs, Honorable Adams, inquired and spoke to me, would we be interested to join them in an oversight visit to the western part of the Northern Cape, called Namakwa. It's the west coast, starting from Honokla Bay up north to Alexander Bay. Specifically regarding three municipalities, Kamiesberg, Richtersveld, and Namakwa. And Namakwa is a district municipality, as well as the mining industry development on the west coast, including Alexander Bay Alex Corp, and rural development linked to agricultural development on the lower part of the Orange River. So I put it to the honorable members, we're meeting again tomorrow afternoon. But that was the question that was asked. 6, 7, 8, and 9 October. After the short recess. 6, 7, 8, and 9 October. The oversight visit is in the planning stage. When we've got more information, we will circulate it to the honorable members. There's a second report that's passed on to me because there's two bills that is referred to. The one was B10-2009, the other one is B11-2009, but in your presentation we received, this was also captured, that the Select Committee on Finance and Appropriation, having considered the Taxation Law Second Amendment Bill, B11-2009, National Assembly, Section 75, referred to it and classified by the JTM, report that it has agreed to the bill without amendments.
Agreed.
Proposal? Seconder? Thank you. Agreed. That brings us to the end of this meeting. Just a reminder, tomorrow afternoon, 16:30, there will be a joint meeting with the staff. Standing Committee on Appropriations, where we will be calling in the Department of Energy, as I indicated when we started this meeting, to come and do their report, because we sent them back. Half past four, we can be out here at about quarter to six, depending on all the questions that all the members will ask. And Friday morning, 9 o'clock, we will be meeting where, yeah, in the same venue, to deal with the provincial departments on health from 9 until 13 hours, M46. And then we wait for the announcements, what's going to happen next week. Here in the corridor says extended constituency period, but we haven't received it in writing. Thank you for your presence. Thank you for your participation. Thank you for Treasury doing the presentation. Our personnel from the committee section and Advocate Jenkins, this meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.